Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.
Welcome to this new episode of New Books in Economics, part of the New Books Network.
This is your host, Andrea Bernardi, from Oxford Brookes University in the United Kingdom.
Today, I'm with Professor John Komlos to talk about his very original new book. The title of the book is Foundations of Real-World Economics. There is also a very interesting subtitle called What Every Economics Student Needs to Know. And this is the second edition published by Routledge in 2019. Professor Komlos, welcome to the podcast. I can introduce to the listener that you have a very interesting background, a very successful career that took place in several institutions around the world. You will tell us something more about this. I will only mention now that you have not one, but two doctorates, one in history and one in economics from the University of Chicago. Welcome. Please tell us something about your career in economics and the origin of your book.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I took my first degree in history, and it was a good choice in the sense that it enabled me to understand a lot of the commotion that is going on today. But I was not able to get a good position in the academic world with that kind of a degree. So I went back to the University of Chicago and received my PhD in economics. And I became an economic historian, which was a very interesting experience at the time. I learned from Robert Fogel, who later received a Nobel Prize in economics in 1993, that there was a relationship between the economy and human biological processes that meant how we grew, how we developed biologically, was impacted by agricultural production, the efficiency of the medical services, all sorts of different things. And I spent about 30 years researching that in that field. I founded a journal by the title Economics and Human Biology in 2003. Which has been thriving ever since, and it was a great experience. Lots of interesting findings, but one of the findings was that the economy had an impact on human beings that was a little bit different from what you get if you just look at GNP figures or income figures. And that led me into thinking in terms of human beings as being the central aspect of economics. Okay, that is to say, it is economics should really not be about money or inanimate concepts like output, GNP, and all this is all good, well and good, but income is an intermediate product in a way. And the question is, how does that income impact the human beings? And through that, I became what I now call a humanistic economist and advocate a capitalism with a human face. And then came the financial crisis, which really meant that mainstream economics was off the tracks. And there I began to start writing a textbook, which really underlined the differences between blackboard economics, a term coined by the Nobel Prize winner Ronald Coase, and real-world economics. And that's what I have been doing ever since, which is now about a good 10 years.
Very interesting. I see this word humanitarian. You define yourself now around this concept of humanitarian. And there is a very original feature of your book in the introduction. There is a section called My Credo. And here you state that your worldview on economics is based on your self being progressive, democratic, and humanitarian. So do you think, first of all, that these should be required to every author of economics textbook to state in advance, to tell their readers what is their worldview? And second, in which way this worldview affected the selection of topics and the way you wrote this book?
Very important to be honest. I think that's one of my big dispositions, that I think that we in academia have a responsibility to be honest. And I think that it is clear that economics cannot be divorced from ideology. You know, Alan Greenspan said this interview in Congress back in 2008, that everybody has an ideology. People were attacking him on his ideology, and he said, "You know, I made a mistake, but everybody has an ideology," and I think that is true. And it is. I wanted to be upfront about it for one thing, and the other thing is I want to stress that mainstream economics claims to be free from ideology, but nothing could be further from the truth, because every assumption that they make, you know, that efficiency is important, is a normative statement. You know, for some people, efficiency is important. For me, efficiency is not as important as equity. You can't really divorce economics from your ideology, and I think we are best served if we put that up front. You know, Richard Feynman, who was a physicist, made a very important a commencement speech back in 1974, in which he said, we have to bend over backward so as not to deceive ourselves. And that is something that we in academia should observe, not to deceive ourselves and in turn deceive our students, because economics is very important. We look around the world today and we see all the commotion, and most of the commotion has to do with bad economic policies. And therefore, it's important for us to be more honest than we have been. In the U.S. alone, more than 1 million students take principles of economics. And all they come away with is that markets are efficient. The point is that these million students go away from principle. They don't take any other economics courses to begin with. So they come away with the wrong intuition. Markets are not efficient unless in very special circumstances, because they are full of imperfect information. They're full of transaction costs. They're full of people who are taking advantage of other people through opportunistic behavior. That's not efficiency. And these kinds of issues are not mentioned in mainstream principles of economics courses. And that is very deceiving.
By the way, before we go ahead with the book, from your career, I would like to make a digression. You taught in American universities, but also for a long time in Munich, in Germany, for 18 years, but also at the University of Vienna. So talking about students, ideologies, and the role of economists while teaching, was there any difference for you while working in the United States or in Europe?
Well, there is a little difference in the sense that alternative viewpoints can find their niche in a European context, more so than here at an American university, because in Germany, for instance, a professor can offer a course without it having been approved by higher authorities. So I was able to teach a course on humanistic economics at the University of Munich, something that I would probably not have been able to do at an American university, where the norms are set at a higher level. In other words, dissenting viewpoints I found could be tolerated more easily in a European context. That was my experience, at least.
Very interesting. And talking about dissent, you refer in the book about the experience of rethinking economics, a network of national organizations that tried to discuss whether our textbooks of economics and our syllabuses and our programs were fit for purpose after the financial crisis of 2008-2009. And they published 13 theses. Those theses were published outside London School of Economics in Britain, and you refer to this experience. And I suppose that your textbook is in line with those theses, and in general with this movement of rethinking economics.
Yes, my textbook is in line with this movement. This is a very important movement, intellectual movement, and it'll take some time for it to mature. And my feeling is that it has to come out on top eventually and overturn the mainstream stranglehold, one might say, that it has on economic teaching, which is very destructive, basically, of the socio-political order as we see today. Why do we have all these problems around the globe? And it has to do with the fact that economists overlooked the downside of hyper-globalization, for example. They overlooked the downside of the kind of incomprehensible inequality that has developed over the years. And it's like a cancerous cell gnawing away at our democratic institutions. It's an incomprehensible phenomenon.
Going back to your book, I would define it also very much political, if I may. Readers will find an illustration with a picture of Rosa Parks at one point, but also from page one in the introduction, they will find the name of the current American president, Donald Trump, here and there. And yes, I think politics plays a role. And I was surprised to find these quotation from Dennis Roderick, the Harvard professor, which is blaming the profession of the economist, blaming the economist for the success of Donald Trump. Can you tell us something about this?
Well, Danny Roderick is one of the few economists who dare to come out and say pretty loudly that you guys were way off the track, because we knew from way back, ever since Stolper-Samuelson's theorem back in the 1940s, that there are losers in the game of foreign trade and hyperglobalization. Now, the mainstream said these losers are going to have to fend for themselves. That was their ideology, you see. They had to fend for themselves. Well, that's all well and good, but if they are not able to do that, they might come back and clobber us over the head, just like other losers in other historical episodes did. And this is something that economists did not contemplate, did not think about. And of course, Donald Trump took advantage of all this despair in the society, that there is an incredible amount of despair in the U.S. economy today. People say the economy is stronger at full employment. Nonsense. In a strong economy, people don't kill themselves at the rate that Americans are killing themselves through the opioid epidemic, through alcoholism, through self-inflicted wounds. About 150,000 Americans this year are going to kill themselves. Well, that's more people than died in the Vietnam War and the Korean War put together, and that's just one year. Okay, so that shows the accumulation of despair in this country, and it's phenomenal, because these are people who are not able to find their way in this very complex economy. And if you're born on the wrong side of the tracks, how are you going to even able to afford to go to a decent high school so you can get into a decent college? You see, you have to start with a decent kindergarten to begin with. So if you're born on the wrong side of the track, or if you're a minority and being discriminated against, it becomes extremely difficult to make your way in this kind of an economy. Consequently, there's a lot of political repercussions of mainstream economists' inadequate assumptions. And that is a shame. They haven't thought about the socio-political implications of their policies. And that's where the vengeance of the deplorables come from.
In the book, you refer to very prominent economists, but you argue that they have a minor role in standard textbooks of macro and micro economics. You refer to Akerlof, Arrow, Kahneman, Krugman, Stiglitz, Taylor, Oliver Williamson, also Herbert Simon. So what role do they play in your textbook instead?
Well, an important role, because I believe that behavioral economics has to be taught at the beginning level from day one. You cannot make the assumption that people are rational, profit maximizer and utility maximizers. That's not a way to begin a discipline on false premises. Because Kahneman and Tversky and Haller and Schiller and Herbert Simon have all shown that these assumptions are false, period. So if you begin your discipline with false assumptions, it is not very likely that you're going to come up with some good theoretical basis for our understanding of economic processes, you see. So I say you got to make the right assumptions. You got to look at the impact of imperfect information, asymmetric information from the start. You cannot just say, well, let's assume that everybody knows everything. That's not economics. That's philosophy. You know, that's nonsense. In the sense, you can make that assumption and you can create a fantasy economy and it's all well and, you know, could be beautiful intellectually, but then don't apply it to the real world, please, because you're going to come up with some, major problems. And the financial crisis is a major problem. You know, Greenspan and Bernanke kept on saying, we cannot have a bubble that is of major proportions. We have what Bernanke called the great moderation, you know, that sort of thing. And then 4 years later, the world was in turmoil. So mainstream economists do not have the right ammunition to understand the real world. They kept on saying, all you have to do is have income growth and we're going to be better off. Well, we're not better off when 150,000 people commit suicide in the United States alone. We're not better off if there are so many people who are desperate for one reason or another. So economists have not come up with the right predictions. We're not happier than we were 30 years ago. Okay, economists would say, yes, we have more income, we should be better off. But we're not better off. At least we don't feel like we're better off, you see. And that is because they overlook the impact of relative income. Relative income doesn't come up in mainstream textbooks. But that's a very important concept because that has a major impact on our welfare. Conspicuous consumption doesn't come up in mainstream economics. So they leave out a lot of basic needs doesn't come up. Look for gender in a basic textbook or minorities. See if you can find African Americans and how they're discriminated against in mainstream economic textbooks. So it's a completely fantasy world that they create, and that's what I'm trying to correct.
Very interesting. We traditionally think that students of economics should have a standard textbook of macro and micro, and then a more advanced but still standard. And then only at the end of the process, or maybe a doctoral level, they should also...
doctoral level, but how many people go to the doctoral level? We have a million students studying economics who take just one course in economics.
Exactly.
You see my point. So of course, it's amazing mistake that we are making by suggesting that you get basic supply and demand, profit maximization, you know, all these sorts of basic tools, and then you build on it 3 or 4 years later. Well, these students are going to be way gone by then, and their takeaway when they become politicians or newspaper authors or whatever.
This is very interesting, and you let me think about an interview I read yesterday by Martin Wolf. And he said, when I was young, I decided to study economics because I was interested in politics. And you cannot understand politics without understanding economics. And then he said, the level of ignorance in our societies about economics is astonishing. So exactly. he was assuming that there are democratic implications of our ignorance of economics, not to mention the fact that the vast majority of books of economics are somehow what you defined mainstream economics, so poor in another respect.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And economists are to be blamed for writing bad textbooks and teaching bad courses to millions of students every single year. Pretty soon, you're going to have a lot of people with misinformation. And that has incredible implications for our lives, for our political system, for our society. Incredible implications. And look at trade. You know, trade is supposed to be good. Americans are going to be better off, Clinton said. We're going to be creating jobs. That's what Clinton said in the 1990s. Hundreds of thousands of jobs. Well, he never said anything about the hundreds of thousands of jobs that are going to be destroyed. Is that a moral, ethical economic policy that does not take into consideration the pain that it causes? It just emphasizes the good part.
The final chapter of your book is on the financial crisis of 2008. I would like to ask you something about this chapter, but also more generally, if you think that we will remember for a long time this crisis, or whether you think that soon it will be just one of the many financial crises that we forgot that we had periodically every now and then since the post-war.
Well, I don't see a lot of people remembering, the pain, and we're still under the pain of that financial crisis. In other words, financial crises are very, very powerful for the simple reason that they affect so many people, and so many people become disaffected and politically become extreme. If you look back in the 1930s, there's no way that we would have had a New Deal in America, which was pretty extreme for the time, without 1929. There's no way that we would have had a victory of the Nazi Party in Germany without 1929. So 1929 had incredible, very powerful political repercussions. Now, 2008 also had very powerful repercussions because we first had elected a revolutionary president, in a sense, Barack Obama, right? We would probably not have elected a African-American president without the turmoil that the financial crisis caused. And he promised us change, on which he reneged because he appointed to positions of authority in the financial realm people like Timothy Geithner, who were responsible partly for the developments that brought us to the financial crisis. So he totally wasted an opportunity to do something like the New Deal back in 1933. Instead, he wanted to overcome the immediate problems of the crisis by bringing Wall Street back into full steam. And that did indeed succeed. Wall Street was doing fine very soon thereafter, but he completely forgot about Main Street. And if you got 9 million people thrown out of their homes, you're gonna get a lot of disaffected people, people who are losing their jobs, unemployed, and who are becoming what Hillary Clinton so disingenuously called the deplorables, which is a deplorable name, right, for people who are being clobbered over the head. Of course, they didn't behave like you would expect middle-class educated people to behave, but you can't really blame them because it was middle-class educated people who made them that way. And therefore, they got riled up, and all you need is, a populist like Donald Trump, and before him, Palin, if you remember Sarah Palin, already in 2008, was similarly inclined, takes advantage of that opportunity, just like Hitler took advantage of that opportunity back in the 1930s. So to me, it's a very sad tale of Donald Trump being the heir of the problems that were created by Barack Obama's policy.
Yes, chapter 14 ends with the bailout, a crisis Obama wasted. Okay. Well, maybe I can sum up your textbook with one of the sentences in the conclusions, which is, this book explores the differences between imaginary and real markets. And you do so through a very interesting list of figures, charts, and diagrams. And the titles themselves of your textbook are very evocative, very original. You don't find another textbook of economics with such unusual, original, evocative titles. And this is why the book has already been successful, among other reasons. I am very grateful for your time. We spoke with Professor John Komlos, that, among many other things, was the chair of economic history at the University of Munich in Germany for 18 years. And he just published a book through Routledge. The second edition is now published in 2019. And this is a very, very interesting book for many potential readers, titled Foundations of Real World Economics. John Komlos, Routledge, 2019. Thank you very much, Professor Komlos.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
New Books in Economics, brought to you by EAEPE, the European Association for Evolutionary Political Economy.